This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. China claimed 3 gold medals on the first day of the Tokyo Olympics on Saturday, and a cyclist became just the second competitor in Ecuador's history to top the podium with victory in the road race. As the troubled buildup to the pandemic-delayed games gave way to the first full day of competition, China secured victories in shooting and weightlifting. The host country, Japan, celebrated its first gold medal of the games in judo, but saw fan favorites in men's gymnastics and swimming eliminated. 17 new COVID Olympic-related cases were announced, taking the total number to 123, of which 12 are athletes. Organizers are also tracking the progress of a tropical storm heading towards Tokyo, with forecasters saying it could arrive on Tuesday. French local television is reporting anti-riot police fired tear gas on Saturday as clashes broke out during protests in central Paris against COVID-19 curbs and vaccination. Television pictures showed police trying to push back demonstrators near a railway station after the protesters toppled a police motorbike carrying several officers. At another protest called by far-right politicians in West Paris, demonstrators opposing antivirus measures carried banners reading, quote, "Stop the dictatorship." French lawmakers are due to vote this weekend on a bill drafted by the government aimed at setting up a health pass and mandatory vaccination for health workers. Uganda this week doled out 25 million euros to government lawmakers to buy new cars, sparking outrage in a poor country troubled by the coronavirus pandemic. Each of the 529 MPs were handed 200 million shillings, or 48,000 euros, about $56,000, to get new vehicles at a time when COVID-19 cases are surging. This is VOA News. Airline flights have been canceled in eastern China, and cargo ships were ordered out of the area as a typhoon churns toward the mainland after dumping rain on Taiwan. It's forecast to hit the coast south of Shanghai on Sunday afternoon or evening. The Taiwan Weather Bureau said the storm had sustained winds of 155 kilometers per hour, about 95 miles per hour, as it moved northwest away from the island. No deaths or injuries were reported there. Rescue teams in India struggled through thick sludge and debris on Saturday to reach dozens of submerged homes as the death toll from landslides and accidents caused by torrential monsoon rain rose to 125. Western India is being hit by the heaviest rain in July in 4 decades, according to experts. Downpours lasting several days have severely affected the lives of hundreds of thousands, while major rivers are in danger of bursting their banks. Parts of India's west coast received up to 594 millimeters, or 23 inches of rain, forcing authorities to move people out of vulnerable areas as they released water from dams about to overflow. Equatorial Guinea Saturday slammed as, quote, "unilateral and illegal" British sanctions against the son of the country's veteran president, known for his wildly extravagant lifestyle, over corruption allegations. Britain on Thursday imposed sanctions on the vice president of the Central West African country and the president's son for his involvement in misappropriation of state funds into his own personal bank accounts. The Foreign Office says he has made corrupt contracting arrangements and solicited bribes. It alleged he splurged $500 million, or 425 million euros, on mansions around the world, luxury cars, and a collection of Michael Jackson memorabilia, including a $275,000 crystal-covered glove that the singer wore on his 1987 Bad tour. But the vice president, quote, "has not made any investment in the United Kingdom," it said, terming the measures, quote, "unilateral and illegal." The sanctions, which provide for an asset freeze and entry bans into Britain, were taken part as a global anti-corruption regime by the British government that also targeted 4 other individuals in other countries on Friday. And the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said Saturday a drone attack was carried out on a military base that hosts American troops but did not cause any casualties. The attack comes with Iraq's prime minister expected to meet U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington on Monday to discuss a possible full U.S. troop withdrawal from his country. It was the latest attack on U.S. military and diplomatic facilities in Iraq, blamed on pro-Iranian armed groups. Find more at voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We have a very robust and free press movement and organization in South Africa. But fortified, of course, by very stable state institutions and an independent judiciary.
The South African government says the Constitutional Court's decision against former President Jacob Zuma should not be a basis for an insurrection.
Work more on the model of consensus building so that we are able to help one another realize and make informed choices and decisions that are for the good of the people that we lead.
The Council of Churches in Zambia calls on members not to endorse political parties and their candidates in the run-up to the upcoming August 12 general election.
People will be allowed to file their amendments through members of parliament to the day. We will debate those amendments, and the superior argument will carry the day. But it is my utmost belief that we should carry through all of these processes before parliament rises in December of this year.
And Ghanaian lawmakers propose a measure that seeks to replace a 1960 criminal code on sexual behaviors. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South African government says the decision by the Constitutional Court that led to the incarceration of former President Jacob Zuma should not have been a reason for an insurrection. Parliamentarian Alvin Boots, Deputy Minister for International Relations, says the South African government is committed to ensuring the independence of the judiciary. His comments follow reports of the arrest of 12 people accused of masterminding the recent unrest. Local media reports at least 212 people died during the rioting and more than 2,000 others were arrested. Some analysts say the country's international image took a hit following the violence, looting and destruction of property. They also say both foreign and domestic investors have been spooked by the unrest and concerns of the country's business community. For more reaction from the South African government about the unrest, I reached Alvin Boots, the Deputy Minister for International Relations.
Our first message as the South African government is to convey a message of certainty and hope, certainty that the South African state institutions is buttressed by a very strong independent judiciary that regards the rule of law as sacred. So no upheaval that gets generated on a dissatisfaction as it relates to the plight of the former president in terms of the Constitutional Court decision should have generated into an attempted insurrection. We have, of course, identified approximately 12 what we call key individuals, and our intelligence agencies has arrested some of them. Some are in custody and more work, of course, is taking place.
So, Mr. Boots, there have been concerns by some South Africans of the widening gap between the rich and the poor. My question is, what are some of the steps your administration or the government in Pretoria is taking to address some of these concerns?
Of course, Peter, the three concomitant challenges facing the South African people is our fight on unemployment, poverty and inequality. So I think we do acknowledge and recognize the interrelation of these very three challenges or pitfalls for a democratic institution such as the South African state. But of course, we have rolled out what we call a comprehensive basket of social security. For example, Peter, 90% of all public schools, that's constitute two-fifths of the entire schools in South Africa, is no-fee school. We have a national school food nutrition program that actually covers 40% of your most impoverished schools. That program on social security is obviously augmented by free housing for the poor, where we have constructed approximately 5 million free houses, benefiting 5 million people. And last but not least, Peter, we have a comprehensive free health care program in place, and we are working in earnest on a national health insurance program to ensure that the inequality gap between the haves and the have-nots in South Africa, of course, gets narrowed. So I think what we are saying as the South African government, that we have maximized the fiscus availability as it relates to social security for the poor in South Africa is concerned.
So, Mr. Boat, what are the steps your administration is taking to address this concern that the recent unrest might have spooked both local and foreign investors who would want to do business in South Africa?
I think our President Ramaphosa has really been the lodestar to ensure the South African investment climate is conducive to attract the required number of foreign direct investment. What we offer, of course, Peter, we do offer a strong financial sector. So in South Africa, a strong financial sector means curbing at a very maximum level the question of illicit financial flows. Secondly, we have a very robust and free press movement and organization in South Africa, fortified, of course, by very stable state institutions and independent judiciary. And of course, for your investment purposes, we have in place quite significant programs to avoid a debt spiral in terms of the public sector wage bill. We are engaging in very rapid structural reforms program, for example, with our state-owned institutions. And we are indeed restoring the health of our public finances. And apart from that, Peter, South Africa is the most industrial economy in Africa. It's SADC's principal manufacturing hub and services destination. And our economy indeed is one of the world's most open economies.
Alvin Boat is South Africa's Deputy Minister for International Relations. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Meanwhile, Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi, founder of the opposition Inkatha Freedom Party, says the South African government should have imposed a state of emergency during the recent violence. He says the administration differed instead of moving swiftly to stop the violence and arrest the perpetrators. Buthelezi, a leader of the Zulu people, also says lack of opportunity for youth, as well as what he says have been years of economic mismanagement and corruption, are also to blame for the unrest. Local media say the violence were instigated by the incarceration of former South African President Jacob Zuma. The Constitutional Court ordered a 15-month jail sentence on the former president for refusing to testify in an anti-graft commission investigating allegations of corruption during Mr. Zuma's presidency. Mangosuthu Buthelezi tells me that lawyers for the former president misled him. He also expressed disappointment in the looting and destruction of property during the violence.
They should have responded earlier. So I cannot add anything to that, because this is an admission that they should have responded more swiftly to this catastrophe, and that they didn't do so. And then, of course, I don't know whether this is the fault of their intelligence or what, but that's the position. That's what the president himself said.
Is that what your reaction is? They reacted too slowly?
It's not a question of me thinking so. They've admitted themselves that they think they should have reacted earlier, more swiftly than they did. They admitted that. It's not a question of my opinion. This effect, which they themselves admit.
Prince Buthelezi, you suggested that perhaps the government should have imposed a state of emergency. Do you stand by that statement?
I do, actually, because this country is ruined, you know, because the economy of this country has already reached a junk status apart from the COVID-19. So clearly, it was my kind of opinion that if they had strictly imposed a state of emergency, maybe not so much loss and damage to the economy, would have taken place.
Some South Africans are suggesting that perhaps is a breakdown or failure of the intelligence or security services to have anticipated that perhaps the incarceration of former President Jacob Zuma could have instigated the unrest. Do you think the assessment is correct?
I think that is absolutely correct, because I also heard the Minister of Police saying that he didn't have intelligence, he didn't have information. So it is true. That is the statement that you're asking me about is absolutely accurate, that you know, they were failed by the intelligence. One doesn't know whether, of course, this is caused by the fact that some of them in the intelligence service itself are people who are involved in the political factionalism that is going on in the ruling party itself, the African National Congress.
What is your position on the current situation with former President Jacob Zuma?
I sympathize with Mr. Zuma because I believe that he was misled by his lawyers, because it is elementary that his actually attitude and the attitude of the lawyers walking out of the capture commission, it's elementary that it was inevitable that they were standing against the rule of law, they were not upholding the rule of law, which only made his oath of office he promised to uphold.
What is your message to the people of South Africa following what you described as this catastrophe?
Let me say, as a black South African, I've said in my country interviews that what our people have done has really made me ashamed of being black, because I can well know that the underlying things which caused the dynamics of this is that our people are very poor, that the inequalities that you show that since the apartheid have not been addressed. But now if they invaded just to get the food, I would not approve of it, but I would still understand that they are desperate. Actually, to go on then to torch businesses when there is joblessness at this enormous scale, I mean, the height of stupidity, as far as I'm concerned, because that is just already exacerbated problems, which in fact were difficult in handling already. Was the country's economy was lying on its stomach.
Are you saying the behavior that you have seen makes you feel disappointed?
I'm saying that as a black South African, I'm disappointed that there are people that have done this, destroyed in facilities which actually are there to serve them. Because I look at that as very stupid indeed. Well, it's much more than cutting one's nose to spite one's face, to actually destroy the very, you know, things that they need every day. Inexplicable, in my view, even if I realize that the poverty of my people is on a large scale as it is. And I saw in some of the informal settlements, some shoppers outside with these informal settlements are miserable structures, and this furniture is too big to be there. So I regard the stupidity myself.
Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi is the founder of the opposition Inkatha Freedom Party. He spoke with me from the KwaZulu-Natal province in South Africa. The Council of Churches in Zambia is calling on its members not to endorse political parties and their candidates in the run-up to the upcoming August 12 general election. The group is urging members to stop giving preferential treatment, including allowing politicians to use the pulpit to speak to their congregation to campaign for votes. It's telling pastors that they and their churches must remain non-partisan and autonomous. The remarks were contained in a recent letter leaders of the Council of Churches sent to all of its members. It comes as Zambians prepare to head to their polls in August to choose a new president and parliament. This after the group also called on political leaders to ensure their supporters do not engage in acts of violence during the election process. Emmanuel Chikoya, who is the Secretary General of the Council of Churches in Zambia and the chairperson of the Christian Churches Poll Monitoring Group, is currently in Dubai monitoring the printing of the ballot papers to be used for the elections. He tells me that politicians should not be allowed to campaign for votes in the church.
The challenge of clergy and politicians indeed is a growing challenge. Because during campaigns, there's been a tendency to have huge donations and clergy opening up their doors to the politicians. It's a practice that as a council we've been able to challenge and advise against. We've refused to be part of the Church Empowerment Fund because we don't want to be caught up. And so as clergy, just like drivers are told, don't drive under the influence of alcohol. We should not speak under the influence of gifts. We have a God-given mandate to speak truth to power, and this gets compromised when we become so dependent on the politicians to build the church. We can build the church through innovative ideas, through making timely investments in season. That is the way to go, and not political donations. This is emerging in some churches, and many more churches must learn from
that. Does that mean that politicians who visit churches who are under your organization will not be giving preferential treatment any longer?
Our members are autonomous. You know, they belong to us as an ecumenical entity, and therefore they are autonomous. There are certain decisions they can make. Some have decided to go for the Church Empowerment Fund. Some have invited politicians as guest of honor. So it's really quite a challenge to navigate around different members. But we emphasize collective responsibility, consensus building, and there are certain things that are frowned upon. And so those who do them do realize that they become an embarrassment to the body of Christ, because they have a short-term relevance, because after government change, they become irrelevant. Those are the consequences of being aligned politically to one political stakeholder.
Well, I understand the Catholic Church, for example, has given directive to some of their priests to ensure that politicians are not given preferential treatment. How are your members reacting to this new urge or calling from the group leadership?
Indeed, one of the Catholic bishops has been clear. He wrote that. We as a council have also written. This matter is a bit complex in the context that there's been deliberate divide and rule tactics. People in the rural settings are met in abrupt meetings and sometimes misinformed, and some, due to poverty, are open and become gullible and are vulnerable. And so it's a constant battle and constant issue of reminding. Going forward, I think there's need for more theological reflections, speaking to the conscience of the clergy, because it's quite a challenge to just manage the vast number of clergy. You have the Protestant churches under CCZ scattered all over the country, you know. And so it is quite a challenge to manage such dynamics. And the COVID-19 has made things worse.
Is the organization going to monitor how these churches are behaving in terms of allowing these politicians to freely campaign or give them gifts during this election period? And will there be any, or is there any punitive mechanism to try to perhaps pressure them to adhere to this directive?
Like I said, the CCZ is an ecumenical umbrella body where membership is voluntary. The churches are autonomous. And so what we do when we any of our members maybe steps out of line is to reach out, to give counsel, to give direction. And we have zonal WhatsApp groups and things like that, and we'll reach out and give guidance in terms of how to behave during elections, and speak and to their conscience and persuade. And so we work more on the model of consensus building so that we are able to help one another realize and make informed choices and decisions that are for the good of the people that we lead.
Emmanuel Chikoya is the Secretary General of the Council of Churches in Zambia and the chairperson of the Christian Churches Poll Monitoring Group. He spoke with me from Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. Lawmakers in the Ghanaian Parliament have proposed a measure that seeks to replace a 1960 criminal code on sexual behaviors. If passed, the measure, named the Promotion of Proper Human Rights and Ghanaian Values Bill 2021 will criminalize those who engage in sexual acts deemed non-heterosexual. Offenders proved to have promoted LGBT activities in the West African nation face up to 16 years in jail. Those found guilty of engaging in acts deemed not to be heterosexual will face up to 3 years in jail. But critics condemned the proposed bill, saying it undermines the fundamental right of LGBT activists. They also expressed regret that the lawmakers aim to criminalize sexual activities between consenting adults. Sam Nate George is the lead sponsor of the newly proposed bill. He tells me that the measure has a groundswell of support from religious leaders, traditional rulers, and the majority of Ghanaians.
We, about 4 weeks ago, presented a bill, a draft bill, to the Right Honourable Speaker of Parliament on the promotion of proper human sexual rights and the promotion of Ghanaian family values. It's going through the Gazette's processes today, 14 parliamentary sitting days process. It appears that before that process is up, which should be in the first week of August, someone has leaked it into the media, and that is what has brought about all the conversation in the country at the moment.
Mr. Sam George, do you have a groundswell of support following this move?
The support is overwhelming. In the 14 weeks that it took me to put together this draft bill, I held 18 town hall meetings in my constituency that I represent in Parliament to find out their opinion. Not one person spoke against the intention to sponsor the bill. In fact, I held 4 consultative town hall meetings, one in the Greater Accra region, one in the Eastern region of Ghana, one in the central region, and the last one in the Ashanti region of Ghana. In fact, the one that was held in the Ashanti region of Ghana was hosted by the National House of Chiefs. And the main speaker at that consultative town hall was the president of the National House of Chiefs, who spoke extensively about the position of the National House of Chiefs of Ghana, which is against homosexuality. So I believe that when it comes to the traditional and religious position, overwhelming majority of Ghanaians, I guess.
But some people are suggesting that why should Ghanaians legislate what two consenting adults do in their bedroom that do not necessarily harm anybody? What do you say to that?
Well, Peter, nobody will play the ostrich and say we didn't know they existed in Ghana before now. But so long as they did it within the confines of the privacy of their rooms, it really didn't bother us. Because, like you said, two consenting adults in their rooms. But when they decide to open an office to support the promotion and advocacy of this, that becomes an affront to what we deem to be, the majority of us deem to be decent in our society. In the United States, where you are speaking to me from, people will be jailed in the U.S. for practicing polygamy. The African culture allows polygamy. So if the U.S. finds it prudent to legislate and have a law that will put a Ghanaian man who per Ghanaian customs is allowed to have two wives, will find him guilty of offending the laws in the United States. If the Ghanaian culture does frowns on and does not allow a man to have intercourse, sexual intercourse with another man, I don't think it should be a difficulty. As a heterosexual man, I don't walk around asking people that I am advocating for my rights as a heterosexual man. So why should a homosexual man want to force his sexual preferences on the rest of us as the way of life? This is a direct response to the affront from that community in Ghana.
Some Ghanaians have expressed concern that there's a potential to violate the rights of members of the LGBT community in Ghana and their activists. How do you address those?
I'm yet to see what portion of the bill will violate their fundamental rights. The fundamental rights of Ghanaians are enshrined in our 1992 constitution. We have a codified constitution here in Ghana. It's a hard copy book. If you take it, if you take the directive principles of state policy, chapter 5 of the 1992 constitution, it is clear. Article 34, Article 39 of the Constitution are clear on what the fundamental rights of a Ghanaian citizen or anybody within the jurisdiction of Ghana are. Clearly missing in those rights are sexual preferences. Sexual preferences are not a fundamental right. I do not see how anyone who wants to say that we are infringing on the rights of a group.
When do you anticipate that debates will begin in the floor of Parliament to debate this measure that you are coming up with?
Well, we intend to take this through the full parliamentary process. And that means that once it's done with the Gazette in a government printing press, which is supposed to be done by the first week of August. The business committee will program it and table it before the House. Parliament will be rising in the second week of August. So it's very possible that it may not be fully tabled before we rise for the summer break. But we will come back in October, and I'm confident that we will take it through that process, the three stages of parliamentary procedure, and have a conversation, have a full parliamentary debate, because it will be referred to the Constitutional and Legal Committee, where persons will be able to send in their memos and disagreements or agreements. People will be allowed to file their amendments through members of parliament to the day. We will debate those amendments, and the superior argument will carry the day. But it is my utmost belief that we should carry through all of these processes before parliament rises in December of this year.
Sam Nate George is a Ghanaian parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the presidential candidate of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, has expressed concern that President Samia Suluhu Hassan has yet to take steps to create the necessary mechanism to return the country to its previous path of burgeoning democracy. Tundu Lissu, a former lawmaker and former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says he's disappointed by the recent arrest of Freeman Mbowe, national chairman of Chadema, and other leaders. He's also calling for nationwide protests to show public dissatisfaction with the president and her administration. Freeman Mbowe and other leaders of Chadema were recently arrested due to plans to meet supporters for an internal party meeting, which analysts say could become a super spreader event. Critics say they could have exposed their supporters to a surge in coronavirus infection cases in the East African country. But Tundu Lissu dismissed the arrest as illegal and an affront to constitutional provisions that guarantee freedom of assembly. Mr. Lissu tells me the arrest should attract international isolation. He wants pressure to be applied on the administration in Dodoma so it will allow political space for critics to freely operate without harassment and intimidation in the East African country.
Well, my reaction to the arrest is one of deep dismay and disappointment. But it is not entirely surprising. I have been saying personally, since President Samia Suluhu Hassan took over, that she has not taken the necessary steps to create the conditions for a return to democracy. She has avoided the issues of the war on democracy started by her predecessor, John Pombe Magufuli. And the arrests prove my point. This one is not a Democrat that people have been thinking about. This one has stated personally, loudly and clearly, that she will continue on the path that was started by John Pombe Magufuli. So the arrests are deeply disappointing and dismaying, but they are not entirely surprising. We should brace for more difficult days ahead. Our friends and development partners internationally should be prepared to take action to isolate this regime.
But Tundu, a lot of Tanzanians were hopeful of her message of engagement, and she's been meeting a cross-section of Tanzanians and promising to meet opposition leaders to address your concerns and all that. Why are you disappointed about this?
The optimism that President Samia Suluhu Hassan meant to change the country was always misplaced. The president, from the day she assumed office on the 17th of March this year, did not say anything about releasing the political prisoners of the Magufuli regime. She did not say anything about removing the restrictions and illegal ban on political activity that was imposed by President Magufuli 6 years ago. She promised to meet with the opposition. She has not done so in 4 months. The only people she promised to meet in order to start a political dialogue, the opposition parties like Chadema, she hasn't met. And now her position now is, if we demand democracy, if even we hold internal party meetings, we are subject to these illegal arrests and detentions. So my disappointment and dismay is not unfounded. It is based on the president's own actions and statements these past 4 months.
What do you say to critics who are saying that your call for isolation and pressure by the international community is unpatriotic, and that you are inviting the international community to influence the internal political dynamics in Tanzania?
Tanzania is a member of the international community, and as such member, it is subject to international law. It is subject to international treaties and conventions on human rights that it is signatory to. The rights that the president and her government are now suppressing in Tanzania are rights that are recognized not only by the Tanzanian constitution, but they are also rights that are recognized under international law in various international treaties. And therefore, when the country breaches its national and international obligations, it must be brought to account. One of the measures that international community does is to take the necessary economic, political, and diplomatic measures to punish those who are guilty of breaching these rules of international law. And therefore, those who hold power in Tanzania and they are abusing their power, they are repressing rights in Tanzania, should not have any place to hide in the community of nations. And that, to say that is not to be unpatriotic.
Tundu Lissu is a former Tanzanian presidential candidate. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. The U.S. Government Accountability Office, or GAO, has released a new report on conflict minerals from the Democratic Republic of Congo and surrounding countries, titled Conflict Minerals 2020 Company SEC Filings on Mineral Sources. The report contains analysis of conflict minerals disclosed by more than 1,000 companies. Officials say the filings were submitted to the Securities and Exchange Commission last year. The conflict minerals include gold, titanium, tin, and tungsten. It comes as armed groups in the DRC and neighboring countries profit from the minerals, which experts say fuel the conflict in the region. For more about the GAO report and analysis, I reached Kimberly Giannopoulos, Director of International Affairs and Trade at the U.S. Government Accountability Office.
GAO has been tasked in the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act to report on the rule that the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, adopted, requiring companies to file specialized disclosure reports beginning in 2014 and annually thereafter for companies that use conflict minerals. So that's tin, tungsten, tantalum, and gold. So what we've been doing over the past 10 years or so is looking at the submissions that the companies have sent to the SEC regarding their conflict minerals and the use of their conflict minerals. So this past year, we looked at the submissions that were due to the SEC by May of 2020. And overall, we found that these filings have been fairly consistent as the past several years, since about 2016 or so. So just to give you a quick overview of what the companies have to do, they have to file a reasonable country of origin inquiry, or RCOI, if they use one of those four conflict minerals in their manufacturing. depending on the determination reached through this inquiry, some companies then have to conduct a due diligence review to further investigate the source of the minerals that they use in their manufacturing. So what we found was about 42% of the companies that submitted these RCOIs reported that some or all of their conflict minerals may have originated in these covered countries, again, the DRC and adjoining countries. About 29% of the companies reported that they were unable to determine the source of their conflict minerals, and about 13% did not report a clear determination. 16% of the companies overall reported that none of their conflict minerals originated in covered countries. And how we found this out was we looked at a representative random sample of the submissions to the SEC. So we looked at about 100 submissions out of the 1,057 total that were submitted in 2020.
What has been the significance, or what is the significance of the report and the anticipated impact on the ground in Congo, Kinshasa?
Yes. Our report indicates that companies continue to collect information about their supply chains to determine whether their minerals are sourced from the DRC or other covered countries. And they use supplier surveys as well as other tools and programs to try to identify this supply chain. And the companies learn more about the practices in the chain of custody of the conflict minerals in their supply chain, ultimately the impact on the ground. However, as you might imagine, these supply chains are quite complex and can contain several tiers of suppliers, from the initial individuals or companies that are harvesting those minerals through processing until they get actually to the final companies that are using them in manufacturing.
So talk to me about what a company can do if it determines that some of the minerals that it's using come from DRC in some of the conflict areas.
That's a very good question. I do want to clarify that the Dodd-Frank Act and the SEC rule is not intended to prevent the use of all minerals from the DRC and adjoining countries. It's to avoid benefiting armed groups from the mining and the sale of minerals. The U.S. government has stated in numerous documents that it is interested in supporting licit, not illicit, but licit mining in the region. So this rule and these regulations are to try to avoid supporting the armed groups. So while we GAO can't really offer specific advice to a company on how to proceed, the key would be for this company to conduct sufficient due diligence about the source of their minerals. And in our report, we talk about the various tools that companies use in order to try to establish their supply chain tracing and some of the challenges that companies engage in or have dealt with in trying to do the thorough due diligence that's necessary to determine whether or not their purchase of these minerals is supporting armed groups.
Kimberly Giannopoulos is the Director of International Affairs and Trade at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. She spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The UN Refugee Agency reports record-breaking numbers of people continue to flee violence in Burkina Faso. The agency is calling for concerted action to address this humanitarian catastrophe, which has displaced 1.3 million people both inside and outside the country. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Attacks on civilians and security forces by jihadist groups in Burkina Faso are increasing in frequency and violence. Over the past 2 years, more than 1.3 million people, or 6% of the population, have become displaced inside the country. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says the speed of internal displacement shows no sign of slowing as armed attacks continue unabated.
The first half of this year, some 240,000 people fled their homes to other parts of Burkina Faso, a sharp increase compared to nearly 100,000 registered during the last 6 months of the year 2020, in the previous year.
The UNHCR says there's been an equally alarming increase in the number of people fleeing across Burkina Faso's borders in search of asylum. It says more than 17,500 people have fled to neighboring countries in the first half of this year, nearly doubling the number of refugees to 38,000. Most have fled to Mali and Niger. However, the agency notes some refugees have fled to Mauritania and Chad, and more risk spilling over to Benin, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Togo, widening the impact of the regional displacement crisis. Balut says a mechanism must be found to bring peace and security to Burkina Faso and to the neighboring central Sahel countries.
These countries which are struggling, they may need support from other countries in the region or beyond, but also what's also important is trying to take care of this displaced population. So the call is for security in the region, but also for resources which help us to take care of this desperate population.
The UNHCR says more money is required to meet the growing humanitarian needs in the region. It is appealing for greater support from the international community. It notes only half of the $259.3 million it has requested has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Loving not me and you, loving you two by two. Even if I lie not true, even if I lie not true, baby. Never me not pay, how I fall for you, pay. Many, many girl want you, me, but still me choose you.
Nikakosa jibu, nikabaki mpweke na ghadhabu. Kumbe hana adabu.
ايه كل ده بقى درجي حلنجي ومزاجنجي بس جد مش كلامنجي ده فتني هوسني تعبني مريحني واشواقي مرجحني
was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a piece of iron can only become what the blacksmith says it should become. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.